Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMC ortho.
Hello again, and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us in the studio today for Medical Monday is Dr. David Ford. Dr. Ford is a board-certified general surgeon at Albany Medical Center. He specializes in a wide range of surgical conditions and procedures, including minimally invasive techniques. Dr. Ford earned his medical degree from Howard University College of Medicine. He completed his internship and residency in general surgery at North Shore University Hospital on Long Island. He is board certified by the American Board of Surgery. He's associate professor at Albany Med. Dr. Ford, welcome back. Welcome. This is your first time. Welcome to Medical Monday.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, we're very proud to have you here. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Dr. Ford, so tell me, what do you spend most of your time doing surgically?
Surgically, we do a wide range of general surgery. Most common surgeries are probably gallbladder surgery, hernia surgery, some colon surgeries. We do some urgent and emergent surgeries for intestinal obstruction, abdominal pain, some soft tissue masses. Those would be probably the extent of the surgeries that I do.
So when you get called in the middle of the night, it could be for something like a strangulated hernia, in which somebody is really having trouble.
That's correct. And actually, most recently, this past week, we did have a similar case where a patient had a strangulated hernia and had to have emergency surgery. And usually with hernias, we hope to repair these electively and that they don't present to the emergency room and to the hospital for emergent surgery. But if they happen to present there, we're more than capable of taking care of that.
To put it mildly, if somebody has a strangulated hernia, they can in fact die, can't they?
That's correct. It's a very serious and severe situation that requires immediate surgical attention. The case that I referred to last week, we emergently had to take that patient to the OR for hernia repair.
And you have to move fast?
You have to move very fast. When it's strangulated, strangulated hernia can actually, the contents can become gangrenous very quickly. And that changes the whole scope of what you're going to do surgically.
And what about colons themselves? Somebody presents, didn't know they had colon cancer and presents in a hospital emergency room with pain. Sometimes you have to go in fast there too?
That's correct. Some patients will present with obstruction, bleeding, perforation, and those are all those are all situations where you have to, you know, act urgently and emergently. Again, you know, the best scenario is to be able to identify the problem, if it's a colon cancer, identify which side it's on, what type, and try to proceed, you know, accordingly.
I know it's great that you mentioned which side it's on, because when I've been in for surgery, they come in 10 times and they say, "Now, what's being done for you today?" So I take it that's to avoid taking the wrong leg off or going into the wrong place.
That's correct. There's a lot of checks and balances that go, you know, through the process of having surgery, whether it's elective or emergent surgery. You want to identify that you're performing surgery on the correct side, the correct organ. And this all has to be, there's a whole process that we go through currently that involves not just the surgeon, the nursing staff, anesthesia, and various members of the surgical team.
And who's on the team? In other words, you're the prime surgeon in this case. Does somebody, you have nurses who are on your team and you know each other's language and how to handle things?
That's correct. There are the nurses that are part of our team, they're involved in surgery, but they may be involved in other aspects of surgery. So it could be that they also perform vascular surgeries, bariatric surgeries, cancer surgeries. But there is a basic universal language among operating room nurses, and then there are specialty instruments that specific nurses will be able to identify.
It's got to be daunting to have to, you know, do that stuff, isn't it?
I love doing it. I think it's it's a, you know, surgery is to me is a wonderful profession. I got exposed to it at a very early age, and once I had that initial exposure, I was hooked.
Oh boy, well that is terrific. So we'll take some calls. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Welcome back, Jim from Matamoros. Jim, you're on.
Hey, what's your favorite suture pattern for hernias, and what materials do you use?
Well, with hernias now, we've kind of evolved. When I initially finished my surgical residency training, we were doing almost exclusively open procedures. Now we do those surgeries, minimally invasive laparoscopic procedures that I perform. And for laparoscopic procedures, for the actual repair itself, we generally use mesh material to buttress along the opening to prevent or minimize the chances of recurrence. The mesh that I use in particular is made of polypropylene for inguinal hernia repairs. And then we use, instead of suture materials, we actually use absorbable, we call them tackers. They're fasteners that allow us to position the mesh in its proper orientation. And then in the skin and the incisions that we use at the skin and the muscle level, we actually use absorbable sutures.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate it. Yeah, bye. Let's go to John in Albany. John in Albany, you're on.
Hey, how you doing? Just have a quick question. My father had a five-way bypass when he was about 72, and I've had a couple of cousins that have had them. And I mentioned to my doctor that, you know, I'd like to get a baseline on where I stand because I'm getting about 67 years old. And I said, you know, maybe I just don't want to be told when I go to the doctor one day, like my cousin, we're sending you immediately to the hospital. I mean, that's literally how it went. So my doctor suggested I go and get a CT scan. They have a thing where they just do the chest. And it came back, I didn't have anything, no calcification or anything. But then a month or so ago, I was reading that the CT scans have anywhere from 500 to 700 times the radiation of a normal X-ray, which frankly shocked me because, to tell you the truth, I like to avoid getting X-rays. And when I found out that this supposedly had a 500 to 700 time the amount of exposure, I was a little floored. So I was wondering if I had made a bad decision. So maybe I could get your opinion on it.
So, John, okay, so, doctor, your opinion.
Yeah, you know, you're right. I mean, plain X-ray, definitely not as much radiation exposure as CAT scans. You know, we try, you know, the CAT scans that we do, we usually like to have a really good indication to do it, you know, rather than subjecting patients unnecessarily to large amounts of radiation. So I think unless you had a specific problem, I probably would kind of lean towards not doing, you know, CAT scans unless there was a specific problem you're looking for.
Do you have any sense, doctor, whether or not research has been done, whether too many MRIs, too many CAT scans basically can leave you at risk?
There's no direct link, but there is some suggestion that if you have too many of these tests that you do increase your, you know, radiation exposure, which increases the chances of having, you know, abnormal cells develop. So that's why we try to be as, you know, cautious as possible and try to really have a strong indication to perform these CAT scans, you know.
And the CAT scans are more powerful than the MRIs?
That is correct.
Yeah. Thank you very much, John. Very good question. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Donna in Lenox. Donna, you're on.
Hi, doctor. I noticed that you are a specialist in minimally invasive surgery, and I'm wondering about minimally invasive surgery for spinal conditions such as bulging discs or stenosis. With nerve pain, is it appropriate, or do they do that?
I would. That surgery I don't really perform, so I wouldn't be able to answer.
He's
going to
defer. We have had people on who do that, and Donna, and I've had it done to me, minimally and robotically done, and it certainly is done. And if you give us a call over here or send me an email at alan@wamc.org, I'll let you know about Dr. Shen who does this, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks, Donna. Bye. 1-800-348-2551. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Health Psychology Associates Albany, New York, providing a spectrum of psychological services, including individual and family counseling, ADHD testing, multicultural counseling, treatment for eating disorders, and more. AlbanyHPA.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, serving hibachi dinners, sushi, sashimi, curry soups, Thai, and entrees. Offering daily specials, 518-432-0358. And Ellis Medicine, a community healthcare network with four campuses serving New York's capital region. Reinventing healthcare, one patient at a time. EllisMedicine.org.
And we are back. Thank you, Zachary. Dr. David Ford is with us today, a surgeon of some note right here at Albany Med. Let us go to Andy in Stillwater. Andy in Stillwater, you're on.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you. Doctor, about 40 years ago at Albany Med, I had a kidney operation with a Dr. Martin. What had happened was the renal artery had crushed the ureter on my left kidney, and he reattached the arteries, I guess, and reconstructed the ureter with what he called a YV pyloplasty. My question for you is, and I guess I should know this, but is that kind of thing last forever?
Yeah, it can last, as long as it can last for a very long time. I don't know
like
if you've
until I'm dead, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there is no reason why it should not function normally. I don't know if you've had any issues with it.
No, I hadn't, but I know how these things like bridges and certain repairs. You think maybe you're done with it forever, and all of a sudden you're doing it again.
It's actually a very good question because, there are always advances in medicine. And one thing gets replaced with another thing, and something to keep abreast of, yes?
Absolutely. The urinary collecting system, it's a low-flow system, so the chances of having, high pressures and even narrowing is pretty remote.
Okay. Hey, Andy, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, let's go to Johanna in Shady. Okay, Johanna, you're on.
Thank you very much. I'm wondering how much you use kind of guided imagery before surgery with your patients. I know there's a woman, Peggy Huddleston, who's written books about preparing for surgery using guided imagery and relaxation techniques, and I heard Bernie Siegel from Yale speak about this about 30 years ago. Is this something that your patients do, and what do you feel about it?
I do think there is some merit to doing guided imagery. We do have a nurse anesthetist that actually does perform guided imagery prior to placing patients to sleep.
For those of us who are ignorant, doctor, could you explain what it is?
It's basically just suggestive relaxation. In this case, our nurse anesthetist will ask the patient to visually image a place or an event that's very soothing and relaxing for the patient as they go off to sleep and as they have their procedures performed.
Ah, interesting. Johanna, do you have any? Did you have anything done with that yourself?
I didn't, but I had a friend, and she actually kind of came up with a mantra, kind of an affirmation that, was relaxing to her, and then she had the anesthetist kind of repeat it to her as she was going under. She felt it was very successful, and she had almost no pain after a major surgery.
That's cool. Thank you, Johanna.
Thank
appreciate
you.
It.
Yeah. Bye.
1-800-348-2551. Got three free phones, folks. You want to get in. Now's the time to do it. Won't be there forever. Let's go to John in Pittsfield. Okay, John, you're on.
Hello, yes.
Hello, you're on.
Yes. My father is in his mid-80s, and a year and a half ago, he had a herniated stomach, was treated with a Nissan procedure. And he has since then he suffers from uncontrollable flatulence, which is really hurting his quality of life.
So what's the name of the procedure again? I'm sorry.
A Nissan procedure.
Okay, doctor?
Yes, Nissan fundoplication is the treatment for a herniated stomach. The main reason to repair a herniated stomach is that you can, again, have strangulation, as we kind of talked about in another organ, another part of the body. Some patients will have increased flatulence as a result of reducing the stomach back into the abdominal cavity. I think he would probably have to see his gastroenterologist to further evaluate and work this up.
Let me just make sure I get this straight. Okay, so you have your stomach rises through the canal. You have a hiatal hernia, and it comes up, and then I have one. Of course, I have everything. And then when it goes down, you lose weight. It tends to go down. You don't have to have surgery necessarily for it, yes?
That's right. You don't necessarily have to have surgery for that. It depends with the caller's loved one. It depends on how much stomach was up in the chest. Sometimes if there's a good amount of the stomach up, it actually will push on the lungs, and it may make it difficult for the patient to take in a good breath.
That's what was happening with him.
There's tonight's nightmare for me. Thank you very much, John. Appreciate it. Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. 1-800-348-2551. Three free phones. We've got a Carl in Greene County. Okay, Carl, you're on.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I have had several bouts of cancer. Removal of a large cyst, which is a gastrointestinal stromal tumor by Allen. And
I don't think I have that one yet.
All right, well, hopefully you... I won't say that. That was 5 years ago, and then it recurred a year later. And they said I was not a good patient for having another surgery, and had been treating me with a drug rather than chemotherapy. And then I had another cancer a year ago with the bladder. They removed cancer from there. And along with this, they're having me do CAT scans on a regular basis, more or less, and I'm concerned about how often CAT scans should go, and is it endangering me further by having the test?
Well, I wouldn't say, you know, I think the physician who was ordering the CAT scan just trying to get an idea to make sure that there's no progression of your disease, and hopefully that the medication that they're using has either suspended its growth or even had it regress some.
It has regressed slightly over the last 5 years.
Yeah, so I think, you know, it's their way of trying to monitor you. This is a totally different situation than our previous caller that said, you know, I just wanted to have a prophylactic CAT scan. I definitely don't agree with, you know, just having prophylactic CAT scans. I think there should be a distinct indication to do the CAT scan, and you definitely fit that mold.
Doc, is there any way other than CAT scan that they could monitor this?
Not really. I mean, you can MRI again. We talked about that previously. That might be another avenue to look at this, but really CAT scan.
So sometimes there's justification for these things.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Carl, well, I'm just wondering, especially since each over 5 year period, each time that I've done it, there has been a slight regression. Mm-hmm. And that being the case, I'm wondering if I might suggest or push for the idea of making a longer period of time rather than every 3 to 6 months.
I think that you would have to consult with your physician about.
So. All right.
Hey, Carl, good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yep.
1-800-348-2551. And we'll go to, is that number one over there? Yeah, it's number one, yeah. We'll go to Mark in Saratoga. Okay, Mark, you're on.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So I just graduated from college in May, and now I'm working at Saratoga Hospital in the emergency department trying to get hours for PA school. And I'm looking at the PA program at Albany Med. And surgery has always interested me, and I was wondering if you could just tell me what a surgical PA, the role is during surgery, and what their knowledge is compared to an actual surgeon.
Surgical PA, we have surgical PAs in our institution that have been there for over 20 years, and they have a whole bunch of experience. I tell you, they're very very helpful to surgeons in terms of assisting with the surgeries, prepping patients for surgeries, and even taking care of the patients post-surgery. They're a critical part of our team. We talked about surgical teams, the members of the surgical team earlier. I find them to be a critical part of our surgical team. Anybody who's interested in being a part of that surgical team, I always welcome them with open arms.
But there comes a point, doesn't there, Doc, that somebody wants to see their doctor, and they said, I've had this happen to me a couple of times, and say, would you rather see the doctor or the PA? I say, are you kidding? I mean, why wouldn't you want to see the doctor?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes we do run into situations where, the patient will specifically ask to see the physician. I think with our practices, we generally try to have the conjunctive evaluation. So even though the PA may see the patient during their daily hospital stay, the surgeon will also be there and evaluate and see and treat the patient.
Well, that's great. Mark, anything else?
No, that's it. Thank you.
Mark, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Again, 1-800-348-2551. Let's go to Tim in Saratoga. Okay, Tim, you're on.
Afternoon, gentlemen.
Hey.
The reason I'm calling is in the sense that I happen to, find the bulbs in my abdominal area, and when I drive truck for a living, and more or less for my DOT physical. They didn't really say much about it. I went to my regular physician, and she's like, "Yep, you got a hernia there. You feel any pain?" And no, it was just left at that.
Yeah, I think the concern with that, initially we used to say any hernia needed to be repaired. And then we kind of went to the other extreme and said, only patients that have pain or nausea or vomiting need to be repaired. But the problem is those patients that, as we were talking about, the patient with the strangulation and incarceration, those are always the big concerns that we have. And we prefer to do these surgeries electively if we can, as opposed to emergently.
Okay, so more or less, I have to more or less be more proactive in this situation?
I think, it won't hurt to be evaluated by a surgeon. If you're a primary care physician, you might want to speak to your primary care physician again and just have him or her reevaluate you. And then, you may just, gently suggest that you might want to have an evaluation by a surgeon.
But you can live with a hernia for 1,000 years, can't you?
Absolutely, you can. Given his occupation, he said he's a truck driver. I don't know if he does a lot of heavy lifting or strenuous activity. That will actually accentuate the hernia, and he may be at higher risk to develop those problems in the future.
When I was 16 years old, go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, what type of surgeon do we ask for? Is this an internist? Is this,
It's usually a general surgeon that will take care of that.
Okay. Economic-wise and everything else with today's insurance and stuff of this nature, what is something like this cost, and how much downtime would I end up with?
Well, the cost is variable. I won't go into the cost, but the downtime, on average, we tell patients not to do any heavy lifting for at least somewhere between 2 to 4 weeks post-surgery, more towards the 4 weeks as opposed to two, depending on the patient's occupation.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you, Tim. Thanks. Gotta go. Thanks
right.
a lot.
Yep,
bye.
Thank you.
Okay, 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. We'll go to Chris in Poughkeepsie, Po-Town. Okay, Chris, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I just have a very quick question. I read a book called Complications, written by a surgeon. He kind of recommended, like, specialty hospitals that do, you know, one kind of surgery. And I'm just wondering if you would recommend that. Like, he was talking about a hernia hospital that specialized in hernias. I know a friend went to a hospital in Cleveland that specialized in cardiac valves replacing, and I'm just wondering what your take on that is.
No, I think there is some merit to specialty physicians. I wouldn't say specialty specialty surgeons, surgeons that have plenty of experience, that have done these procedures over and over again. I think you can't go wrong with that. I've been in practice for 18 plus years. I've done tons of hernia surgeries, and I feel very comfortable doing them.
Should you ask the doctor you've been referred to how many he's done?
Absolutely. I think you should ask him how long they've been practicing, how many surgeries they've done. You know, those are all legitimate questions.
Well, everybody's got to start somewhere. So what if somebody asks you the first day, David?
Yeah. Well, I think it depends on how comfortable the patient feels with that surgeon. You know, if you don't feel comfortable at all, if they're saying, well, this is my first 10 or whatever, then you need to try to find somebody that has more experience.
Is there a graceful way out? Well, let me think about it or something like that.
Yeah, we'd probably say, let me think about it step out of there.
Okay, well, that's great. Thank you very much, Chris. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's see. We're going to go to Nancy in Tivoli. Okay, Nancy, you're on. Nancy? Yo. Hey, Nancy, you there? Did something happen? I don't know. Let me try pushing that again. Nancy in Tivoli, you there? Huh. Well, probably not.
Okay, hi.
Oh, you're good. I know what you were doing. You were listening to the radio, and there's a seven-second delay, and so you got to listen on the phone.
I'm sorry, because I didn't know. They said they would put me in the queue, but it sounded like, you know, my call might not
be as
important.
It might be forever. Yeah.
So.
Okay, but let me just articulate for everybody now. Rule number 7 is that you have to stay on the phone, okay? You can't go away. All right, Nancy, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry, Alan.
So, right.
I wasn't aware of that. My question is, since the doctor talked about those of us, and I'm 78 now, who had our feet x-rayed constantly when our mothers were shopping at the shoe store, has there been any survey or study done what happened to us people from that? The tops of my feet hurt, and I wondered when he mentioned that, could it be from all those years of standing on the fluoroscoping machine?
I don't think there's any studies that have alluded to that, and I really couldn't comment on that, to tell you the truth.
Okay. Thank you. It made me curious.
Thank you, Nancy.
Bye.
Yeah, bye. 1-800-348-2551. Don in Schenectady. No, that says, that's not working. Hey, something's happening here. Something's not quite right. Don in Schenectady, call back. Okay, we'll go to Chris. No, we won't either there. Everything's sort of out. Okay, we got an email here. Why are most scheduled surgeries always done in the morning? Why is surgery scheduled this way? Well, there's a premise here. Johnny Carson used to say, by the premise, by the gag. It just happens that the premise is wrong.
That's true. Most surgeries, we start our procedures very early in the morning, usually around 7, 7:30 in the morning we start the first procedures. And then we just go throughout the day. And, you know, depending on the nature of the procedure, some of these procedures may take a half an hour, some may take longer. But the earlier we start, the more surgeries that we can get in and get finished and get accomplished.
Okay. That takes care of that one. Let's go to... I got it. Helena. Helena, you on?
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. Can you hear me?
I can indeed, and I thank you. Go
okay,
ahead.
Dear people. It appears that a lot of your listeners and callers are concerned about radiation exposure, and the Consumer Reports have put out a wonderful comprehensive article concerning radiation and the type of tests, you know, that a patient may have to undergo. And also, it's very proactive in telling you what questions to ask. So if your listeners are interested, it's the March 2015 copy.
Okay.
issue, okay?
That's so nice of you.
Yes, and your doctor that you have on, is, I think he's right on target.
He's wonderful, isn't he?
Yes, he
thanks,
is.
Thanks, Helena. Bye-bye.
Thanks, dear. Bye-bye.
Okay. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from the Stram Center, investigative medicine specializing in Lyme, women's health, gastrointestinal, cancer treatment, acupuncture, and nutrition. Located 10 minutes from Albany and in Bennington, Vermont. StramCenter.com. And Mass Mocha, North Adams, Massachusetts, presenting the live music and video of Zamuto and special guest performer Gotia on Saturday. MassMocha.org.
And we are back until the end of the show now. So if you've got a question, okay, we hung up on Don from Schenectady, and we're going to go to him first. Okay, Don, welcome back. You're on.
Hi, who's this, Alan?
Yep, very same.
Hi, Alan. Don from Schenectady, calling you, old working partner with you from years back.
Indeed.
But I got a question for the doctor. I had a EGD. About 2 weeks ago, found a cancerous polyp, and now they want to do it's a relatively new procedure. Well, I understand about 5 years. They go down with a scope and they remove that polyp. The doctor familiar with that?
Yes, there is some familiarity with that. You know, when they remove the polyp, it depends on whether they're able to get the polyp removed with free margins. Mm-hmm. If they are able to do that with free margins, then you may not, you know, again, you'd have to consult with your gastroenterologist, and you may have to see a surgeon, or you may actually wind up undergoing surveillance where they just repeat your endoscopies at certain intervals.
I see. Okay.
All right.
Okay,
thanks, Don. Good luck to you.
Okay, thank you, Alan. Yeah, nice talking to you.
Yeah, bye. And we'll go to Kirsten in... Kirsten, I don't know where you are, but go ahead, Kirsten, you're on.
Hello?
Hello, Kirsten.
Yeah, hi. Yeah, I have a question for the doctor. It's about my husband who needs hernia surgery.
Yep.
He works as a dentist, and he's debating whether he should have it, you know, in the summer or in the winter. And we wondered, like, is he going to feel pretty good after the surgery? Like, does he want to take 2 weeks to be at home? Or could we, like, schedule a trip and, you know, he would feel good enough to be on the trip? That's question number one. And question number two is, I'd kind of like him to have the surgery in New York City. He maybe wants to have it upstate. Would it be tricky right after the surgery, like the day after the surgery, to take a 3-hour car ride, or would you feel good enough to do that?
Well, to answer the first question, what type of hernia? Is it an inguinal hernia or a ventral hernia?
I'm not sure.
So is it a hernia that's down in his groin, or is it a hernia that's near his belly button?
Near his belly button.
Near his belly button. So that type of hernia repair is a little bit different than when we perform inguinal hernias. And ventral hernias tend to be a little more uncomfortable after the surgery. So it might be tougher for him to, you know, say, okay, you know, a week later I want to go, you know, and vacation. You know, I would think it might take him up to about 2 weeks before he would feel a lot better.
Should you make sure there's a doctor on the ship if you're going to go?
You need a surgeon.
There is one. They can be from any country. He was noticing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, that's cool. But, yeah. Okay, yeah. So he might not feel that great for a week.
Yeah, for a week to about 2 weeks. And then usually at 2 weeks, most patients feel
now, tell me
good,
about so. This belly button thing. I know what an inguinal hernia is. I had one. But what happens in the belly button?
Belly button, sometimes either congenital, like you're born with an opening, a small opening there, which may enlarge over time. Or if you've had previous surgery, you can develop a herniation because now when you have surgery, you have weakness of the abdominal wall. And the contents of your abdomen can pop through. So, yeah.
Interesting. Well, Kirsten. Go ahead.
So for my second question, so he might not really feel that good and want to take a 3 to 4 hour car ride a day after the hernia surgery.
That is correct. Yeah, for that particular hernia surgery, I would say I would probably tell them not to do that.
Well, let's
take
put. Wait a second,
days.
Kirsten. Wait a second. Let's put it right on the table.
Mm-hmm.
People say, "Oh, you know, we want those New York surgeons. We don't want them up here in Albany." Well, is there anything to that? I mean, are you as good as the other guys?
I'm just as good as the other guys. No question about
it.
Yeah, I'm sure you are.
He needs to find someone he's comfortable with.
Absolutely. He hasn't quite found that person yet. That's the bottom line, is that you have to have a good relationship with the physician and patient.
And obviously
you want to have a surgeon that has a lot of experience. And then
exactly.
the other question is, a lot of times we do minimally invasive surgery now. So, you know, that's pretty much the standard unless the patient has incarceration or strangulation.
So that's pretty standard. So that's something you do commonly, is minimally invasive?
That's correct, yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. And so, again, it would take a few days before he would really want to be in a car for 4 hours.
That is correct, yeah. If he's taking a short trip, it's perfectly fine. But a three-hour trip, I think it would be a little tough for him. So.
Okay.
Okay.
And what's the recovery time? So it could be 2 weeks. It could be 3 weeks.
Yeah.
He's in a rush to get back to his dentistry practice. So, you know, it's not heavy lifting, but it is standing.
Yeah, usually about 2 weeks, I would say. If he's not doing heavy lifting, yeah, he should be fine in about 2 weeks.
Okay, super.
Thanks a lot, Kirsten. Okay, your chances of getting in now are really, really, really good. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Tonight, you're going to be lying in bed, and you're going to say, "I could have called this terrific surgeon, Dr. David Ford, and I could have asked him a question. But instead, I was afraid or lethargic. I didn't do it. And now I feel so bad I can't fall asleep." Okay, but you're being warned. Now is your time. Let's go to Chris in Albany. Okay, Chris, you're on.
Hi. I'm in a situation where I might have to have my spleen removed. And I am looking for advice on how to find a surgeon that has experience with that particular organ. Also with partial splenectomy, since I don't really want to lose my whole spleen if I don't have to.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're having the splenectomy for. So if it's for... if it's for like an issue with partial blood supply or infection of a portion of the spleen, then partial splenectomy is perfectly fine. If it's for a tumor, then that's different. Then you may actually wind up having to have total splenectomy. Also for trauma, I used to be a trauma surgeon. We do partial splenectomies or try to preserve the spleen as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. They found a growth in the spleen, and they evaluated for hemangioma, and it doesn't seem to fit the pattern, and they're going to do one more test just to rule it out.
Yeah.
If they're pretty sure it's not a hemangioma, they're going to do a biopsy. They don't think it's malignant. In that situation, it is rather large, though. In that situation, when you say a partial splenectomy is not indicated...
No, I think it's hard to say without looking at like your imaging studies to determine whether partial splenectomy is okay in that situation or not. The spleen is very, very fragile. So we are able to do partial splenectomies nowadays. Obviously, the biggest concern whenever you do any splenectomy is bleeding. So, you definitely want to make sure it's somebody who's experienced in dealing with spleens. And again, with just like with other organs, we are able to do the procedure through minimally invasive means now.
Okay, mm-hmm. Chris, we're done. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it a lot.
Right.
Okay. All right, we'll go to Gloria in Cambridge. Gloria, you're on.
Hi, how are you, Alan?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. I just have a question for the doctor. How can you tell a difference between one surgeon, a good surgeon, and a bad surgeon? I would think they're all pretty much trained well. I guess you would just look them up, but how do you tell?
That's a very good question. I mean, it's tough, because not all surgical experiences are the same. There's a lot of differences now in terms of ability to perform one surgery versus another. There are areas that are becoming more specialized, but I think through your primary care physician, he should be able to steer you in the right direction. They generally will know who the good surgeons are. You can look up the surgeon as well. They have health grades now where you can actually look up the surgeon and determine their ratings and make decisions based off of discussions with your internist and your own research.
But I don't, we were talking about this before, Doctor, and there's always a problem with that. I mean, there are some surgeons who are much more courageous than others and who will take on, you know, the most dangerous cases. And so, therefore, their outcomes may not be as good as some, you know, middle-class guy who just does the safe stuff.
No, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, there are patients that are much higher risk patients, and, you know, the discussion between the surgeon and the patient, they determine that, but that they may have higher complications, and as a result of that, their gradings will actually fall as a result of that. You're absolutely right.
Gloria, thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Teresa in Elizabeth. Teresa, you're on.
Hi there. I got a question about prescription drugs, particularly prescribed for the elderly. It seems like drugs are designed for purposes to address particular issues. And I forgot the phrase, sometimes prescribed out of
off-label,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah. So Seroquel for elderly people with dementia, NIH and Institute of Medicine, they say it's a risk for early death, and I couldn't get them to take my elderly mother off of it, and she wasn't having psychological issues. And I'm just wondering, what is your opinion about the use of elderly, drugs like Seroquel for elderly dementia patients?
Unfortunately, I don't really have an opinion on that. I'm a surgeon, so I don't really prescribe Seroquel.
Oh, I didn't realize
I don't really have an opinion.
Teresa, yeah. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate it a lot. Okay.
Thank you.
We'll go to David in Schenectady. David, go.
Two quick questions about surgery. One, why are the theaters for surgery so cold?
Why are they? Oh, the theaters. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. I didn't understand that initially.
The rooms.
Yeah, the rooms are cold normally. Well, it depends. Like if you're working on a pediatric patient, they generally keep the rooms pretty warm. They're actually very hot, believe it or not, because we want to keep the babies and the young children's temperatures up. But overall, they're cooler, and it has to do with a lot of the instrumentation. You don't want those instrumentations overheating anesthesia machines. Now we do a lot of laparoscopic surgery and robotic surgery, and all those machines actually have to be at a slightly cooler temperature.
Okay, David, you have a second question.
Second question. An old surgeon once told me years ago that 90% of the healing that takes place after surgery is done within 2 weeks. In other words, you're 90% healed up after 2 weeks. Does that sound right?
That is not true. Most maximum healing generally takes about 6 weeks. I don't know if you watch sports or not, but when you hear about a famous sports individual, they generally will tell you that they're going to be out for about 4 to 6 weeks. 6 weeks is usually the maximum amount of healing.
Okay.
David, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Moving on, we'll go to Patrick from Troy. Patrick from Troy, you're on.
Hello, doctors. You scared me into calling with your description of the consequences of strangulated hernia.
Yeah.
Silly question. How will I know if and when I'm in trouble, or will I know soon enough to take action?
Well, hopefully you will be evaluated, you know, periodically by your physician, and they can help you.
I haven't been to a doctor in a long time.
Oh, so that's an issue. So I think that's probably where I would start, is at least have someone evaluate you and examine you. For the most part, I tell patients, you know, if you have a hernia and you lay down and the hernia goes away, it goes back in and you can't really feel it, then you're probably okay, but you still need to be evaluated by a physician.
Okay, yes, that happens sometimes, not all the time, but fairly often, actually.
Yeah, if you start having pain, it's bulging out and you lay down, it doesn't go away, you have a nausea, vomiting, those type of symptoms, then I would definitely say you need to seek help right away.
Okay, in the meantime, I should probably come and see you one of these days, right?
Sounds good.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
All right. We'll go to Marie. Okay, Marie, you're on.
Hi, I thought of a second question. My first question was about my hernia, not hernia, sorry, an appendix that I had to take out. I didn't know what it was, but it was emergency. It was ready to pop, And when they took it out, it was a small incision, but it was near my belly button.
Okay.
And they said that that's not really that's kind of not too common, but I don't know for sure. He said most Chinese people have that, and I'm not Chinese, with the location. So that's one question. Is that a normal thing for my appendix to be there, to have been there? It's gone now. And then my second question is, now that I'm frightened about getting more surgery done for this stuff, I have an inguinal hernia that's in my right groin near the leg where it joins my body, and there's a little mass under it. But I'm afraid to have any surgery done unless I know I have to have it done, tamper with something that, why bother fixing something that doesn't need fixing? But because of my previous experience with the appendix, I'm wondering if I should go ahead and be proactive here.
I would think proactive is the right thing to do. As far as your appendix is concerned, the appendix can be in actually various positions. It doesn't have to do with any
predisposition.
Yeah. So it can be, it can lay in your pelvis. It can hide behind your colon. It could be towards your belly button, as you described previously. The key is that that you have if you're having symptoms from your appendix, that you have it removed in a timely fashion.
Especially since appendixes don't do anything for us, right?
That's right. There's no real function of the appendix nowadays. So the second part. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes. What should I think about then the inguinal hernia? Am I supposed to expect it to have a happening of some sort that I should look for that?
Well, some patients can go through their entire life and have hernia, and they don't necessarily have to have surgery for it. But if you notice that the hernia is progressively enlarging, then again, I would tell you that you need to at least seek the opinion of your primary care physician, and then he can probably refer you to a surgeon if he thinks it's necessary.
Marie, got to let you go. We're running out of time here. Thank you very
much.
Thank you. Okay, we'll go to Dick in Long Meadow. Dick in Long Meadow, you're on.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. Just a quick question, and I'm sure you're the surgeon has seen a lot of this. What causes sebaceous cysts? It seems like people have these cysts and they have to be drained and excised, and most of them are non-malignant. If you could just comment on that, sir.
And before you do, let us know, Doc, what they are.
Yeah, sebaceous cysts are actually hair follicles or sweat glands that become blocked, and the oils that are produced are not able to be drained through at the level of the skin. And as a result of that, you actually develop a ball of oils. The oils become hardened, and they are encased in the actual sweat gland itself. And these can become infected. You can develop abscesses from them. Usually if they're asymptomatic and they're small, you don't necessarily have to do anything. As they enlarge in, or if you become symptomatic from it, then we prefer that they are surgically removed.
And when you surgically remove it, you go in laparoscopically or no?
No, this is not a laparoscopic procedure. This is usually, for the most part, is an outpatient procedure. You can have it done either in the office or surgery center, yes.
Interesting. Okay, yeah. Dick, Frank, thank you very much. Appreciate
thank you, sir.
Okay. Bye. We got an email here from our friend Mark. He says, good afternoon. What would you say is the most difficult part of the body to operate on, and why?
Ooh, that is a tough question. I'm going to say, and I don't do this surgery, but I'm going to say probably cardiovascular surgery. I mean, obviously the heart is your pump and it's the life force. I think just watching those, the cardiothoracic surgeons, I'm always in awe in terms of what they're able to do and working with clogged arteries and valves and things of that nature.
Wow. Well, that answers that question. Well, my friends, we're out of time. My apologies to no one because nobody was left on the line. And I want to thank Dr. David Ford. David, you were wonderful today. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you very much.
For joining us. Thanks to our engineer, Zach Malloy. Thanks to Joe Makowitz for answering the phones with great distinction. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wamc.org/voxpop. Stay tuned now for a news update.